Welcome to the Central Seminary Podcast. Thanks for joining us today as we discuss biblical and theological issues relating to life and ministry. This podcast is a ministry of Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Plymouth, Minnesota. To learn more about Central Seminary, visit our website at www.centralseminary.edu. My name is Jared, and I'll be your host. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Central Seminary Podcast. Hopefully you found our first episode and hopefully you found it helpful. And let me just say, if you want to give us feedback or thoughts or on this episode series or other episodes, you can write us info@centralseminary.edu. We don't get a lot of personal feedback from people, but if you want to say, hey, we'd love to hear you talk about this topic, we're open to that and can't guarantee that we'll talk about it, but we'll put it through to the professors and we'll think about that. So we want your feedback. We want to hear from our listeners and see how we can better serve you. But we're back with part two of Gender Dysphoria. We have Brett Williams, Provost of Central Seminary, with us. Thanks for being back, Brett.
Certainly. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
So where we left off last time, I want to go back a little bit. We were talking about reading, and we asked the book that you read, and you promised to fill us in
there
on
it is.
The
and
author.
I had just actually started it. So it's called Inventing the Individual. The author's name is Larry. Last name is Seidentop. He's at Oxford in England. He's a great philosopher. And so certainly I think that our listeners would enjoy that book. It's a little philosophical, it's more academic, but it's a great book just on the origins of how the Western mind really thought of and how we invented this concept of an individual and how that really has maybe bled into a lot of our senses and thoughts, et cetera.
Okay.
So it's a great book. I'm about halfway through it.
All right. Well, let's do some recap. We got into some good discussion last time. We talked about the difference between essence and action or nature and identity and some of those categories. You talked about John Paul Sartre and how he broke some new ground there. Can you just kind of go back and maybe recap some of that stuff to lay another foundation that we can build off for today?
Sure, yes, at least I can try. And again, I want to be careful that this isn't reductionistic. However, for most of human history, the concept of existence actually stemmed from an essence idea, what's called the essentialist idea, right? So there is in the mind of God, or you could call it that out in the transcendent, if you will, there is a concept of reality. This gets into Plato a little bit, right? But there's a concept of reality that is reflected through us, through our lived experiences, who we are, even the physical realm itself. And so essence logically preceded existence. Mm-hmm. So let's say for the topic at hand, you live like a man because you are a man. Your essence is masculine. Therefore, how you engage in this world, regardless of when and where you are, right? Because obviously those things are relative, right? So what a man looks like in one society may differ a little bit than what a man looks like in another society. Mm-hmm. However, that is based on your essence. And so simply because you're a man, then you live as a man. Whereas one of the things that existentialism does, in specific Jean-Paul Sartre, he inverted those logically and actually said, no, your existence, and so we begin with you, how you maybe interact with the world, how you see yourself in the world. This is a result of the anthropocentric shift of modernity, of course. So what Sartre did is he saw that, oh no, how you experience the world, that's the true you. That is the fundamental essence of you. Mm. So then existence now precedes essence. And of course, you can see what has happened since the 1950s and 60s, how that has worked its way into so many different aspects.
Yeah, so he took away the category as being outside ourself and maybe defined outside ourselves and defined it by our own human experience.
Sort of, in a sense. It's not that he would deny the transcendent.
Okay.
He would say you just have to inverse the order. So you're a man because you live as a man right now, not because of some great metaphysical, let's say, truth in God, right? He was more of an agnostic when it came to that. But it wasn't simply Sela Sathra. It was many others, right? You know, you go all the way to, let's say, Kierkegaard, who kind of does this a little bit with the concept of faith, right? Faith is this leap in the dark because truly it's Christianity doesn't make any sense. He was completely reacting against, you know, let's say Aquinas and all the scholastics, and that was really the origins of it. And slowly but surely, again, we have this man-centered turn to now how we see the world and existence is through our own existence first. Then we can extrapolate the outside. So existentialism really, I'll say, reversed what had been happening in Aristotle and Plato, etc.
Okay. So why don't you talk to us about the term or the idea of gender and gender and grammar and how some of that developed?
Yes, and so our last episode, we introduced a character, John Money, and I told you a little bit about his background. He was instrumental in understanding how the current mind, especially Western mind, thinks about sex and gender, biology, etc. Because what he did is he took a category that we call gender. Now, again, this has existed for all of human history. However, up until 1950s and 1955, I believe, it was almost exclusively, and I hate to say these things because I always like to, you know, nuance my terms, but it was about exclusively used through and in the realm of grammar. So you think of language, right, especially nouns or predicate nominatives, etc. They have a masculine or a feminine, right? So Greek in specific has a masculine, feminine, and neuter. Same with Latin, whereas Hebrew just has the masculine and the feminine. So if you study the history of language, really, and the philosophy behind it, that idea was that, okay, that there are certain things in this world, again, what's a noun, right, person, place, or thing, that corresponds to this transcendent reality. So the word gender was used exclusively for language. It was not associated with biology or sex, right, with masculinity and femininity when it comes to physiology. What John Money did is he moved that idea, right, to the biological. But then he said, well, wait a sec, we're going to separate the two things. So your gender has to be a part of the inner you, your psyche, if you will, right? So that's who you are. However, gender roles, those are simply some sort of a sociological, I'm going to call it, construct. And so those are just invented by society. So he was the first, really, to have this wall of separation in between your physical or the physiological and your gender or your psyche.
Hmm. And so they would view humanity almost as our insides of the real self, and our physical or material or body is just kind of a shell that houses the real you.
Yes, exactly. And we've seen this before in history, right? I mean, in some sense, this is Gnosticism, right? So the idea that even, you know, at least in a proto sense, I think this is what Paul fought in the New Testament on, certainly among other heresies. But this idea that the spiritual realm is the true realm, that's where your reality is. The physical realm, that's kind of a bad realm that's external. Right? You see this obviously in, let's say, you know, like, let's say John's epistles, right, to the first John, where he has to prove right away at the beginning that, no, Jesus wasn't simply some apparition. He wasn't simply a ghost. He was real, right? Mm-hmm. So they heard him, they held him, they touched him. This is what John said.
Yeah.
So I do think we see some sort of corollary in between this modern idea that there is this absolute wall of separation or bifurcation between your psyche and your physiology, right? Because I think two mistakes maybe come from that. And if you look at the ancients, you'll see, again, this has happened before. Gnosticism made two fundamental errors that led to two mistakes. Certainly, error number one is that the spiritual has to be the true. It's the only authentic. Number two is that means physical doesn't really matter, right? So as you see from certain heresies, especially, you know, maybe Christological heresies like Docetism, that, okay, we're going to emphasize the spiritual nature of Christ, yeah, to the detriment of the physical. Well, the Council of Chalcedon dealt with that, right? He is true God and true man. You cannot somehow maybe overemphasize or even underemphasize. And so what Gnosticism leads to is either this overemphasis on the spiritual or an underemphasis on the physical. And we see that now, right? Most, I'll even say Christians, believe that humans are made up of material and immaterial. The question is, how do those things relate to one another? Because if you completely separate them, then all we are really are shells, right? We're simply physical, and the true us is our spirit. Well, I'll say it historically, that's been rejected by most of Orthodoxy, right? Because you are both material and immaterial. And this is something this time of year especially, because as we're recording this, this is on Good Friday. This time of year, we celebrate the idea of the resurrection. So if your true self is your spiritual self, right, and the body is simply some sort of a housing, let's say, or an outside, then what's the point of the resurrection?
Yeah.
Why does it say all of Christian theology, according to Paul, right, all of Christian theology hinges upon the resurrection, not simply the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but the resurrection of Jesus Christ is, I'll say, as a foretaste of the resurrection, our resurrection.
Yeah, and not just resurrection, but bodily resurrection.
That's exactly
not just a spirit resurrection.
Yeah. So, all right, so if your body really doesn't matter in Christian theology, then what's the point of the bodily resurrection?
Yeah. Now, you introduced two terms there, and I want to make sure we get a definition of them. One was Docetism, and that's the idea that Jesus simply seemed to or appeared as God. The Greek word dekeo means to seem or to think.
Yep.
That Jesus, what did I say as God? As a human, Jesus wasn't really human. He just kind of seemed to appear that way.
Yes.
And that kind of goes with what you're saying of, you know, the outer body housing the true self inside. The other term you mentioned was Gnosticism. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give us a good definition for that?
That's a good question. That could be an entire podcast itself.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, that was, to our best knowledge, that arose really in the second and third centuries. That's why I referred to what Paul was dealing with as proto, right, or incipient Gnosticism. It's this central idea that there is a realm outside of ours, right, in that there is this hierarchy, right, and that hierarchy, the spiritual, is reality. The physical was an inverse of reality, right? So again, I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but you had the idea of bythos, right? And then emanations, right? And there was an emanation or a thought of a spiritual thought that actually then took on some sort of a form, right? Mm-hmm. So then Yahweh was an emanation that made a mistake in creating the physical realm, right? And hence, Jesus was the spirit that wanted to help mankind in the physical escape that sort of physicality to the true realm of the spiritual. That's Gnosticism 101. Again, I want to be careful. You could do so much more. I don't want to oversimplify here.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different thoughts or different emanations of it.
There it is. That word.
Those of you who took Dr. Bowder's systematic theology there, will
you'll understand
that one.
This.
So there's a hyper obsession almost with the mystical, the unseen realm, and that's what really matters. The physical isn't as important.
Yeah. So, and let's bring it back to the idea of gender, right? So I think what many people assume is that gender is just some sort of a construct in society, right? So women behave like women simply because of Western society, and men behave like men because of Western society, right? So if you look at maybe John Money, what he did is he believed that humans were a blank slate. Now, not many who are in psychology hold to this anymore, but humans are a blank slate. Therefore, gender really doesn't exist in that sense, right? So he would say that boys and girls are not made. Excuse me. He would say that boys and girls are not born. They're made. Mm. Okay. So that has been, I'm going to say, disavowed or let's say, proven, even though you can't really prove the psychological, right? You can't use the scientific method on it necessarily. However, at the same time, what really stuck was his idea that you can separate biology, or the physical, your physiology, from gender, right? So sex refers to the, let's say, the physical or the biological, whereas gender has to do with your experience, whether that's the inner you, your psyche, how you see things, or how you experience the world around you.
Okay. Wow, that's a lot to put on our minds.
Well, and this is very important, right? Because, you know, right now a question that's being asked is, what is a man, or what is a woman, right? And I think Christians, especially the last maybe 30 or 40 years, I think we've made somewhat of an error, right? Certainly what makes a man, and a woman, has to do with your physical, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say chromosomes, if you will, all right? So women have the XX and men have the XY. Certainly, let's say physiology is different. Those things are important. Biology matters. However, if we put all of our eggs into that basket, it's not like because the ancients didn't know what makes a man because they didn't understand, you know, a DNA, yeah, right, and a chromosomal structure, which, remember, those are really recent discoveries, right? So it's not that those things don't matter. It's that that's not the essence. This is where I'm going to espouse what's called as the essential view, right? So when God made Adam and Eve, and I believe they were historic human beings, so they were true. It wasn't just a myth.
Yep.
Adam was historical. Eve was historical. Certainly as not just the proto-humans, but the prime humans, if you will. That idea of the masculine and the feminine, you think of what Moses says in Genesis 1, right? Male and female, he created them. They're both made in the Imago Dei, the image of God. It's not that one has more or one has less. We need to be careful. And I think sometimes some, let's say, very conservative, maybe complementarians, make this mistake of somehow the females are a subspecies, if you will, of the male. That's not what historically, certainly not what orthodoxy has seen, except what it is, that they're both made in the image of God, yet the male and the female are in their sense or their essence itself. It's part of their ontology, not simply a part of their biology. Now, biology then has to correlate with their essence, their ontology. So you cannot truly, maybe, shall I say, like distinguish the two, like money attempted. However, one is sourced in the other. So their biology has to be sourced in their ontology. This gets back to the whole idea of essence then preceding existence. You could also say essence precedes the physical. Not that we're going to make the mistake of Gnosticism, right? To yeah, where we say, oh, there's this wall of separation. They have nothing to do with one another. No, they're both and. That's the point, I think, of Genesis 1 and 2, that you have these two humans who are both made in the image of God, who are not opposites of each other. They are what we see as complements of one another. That's why, you know, God made the animals walk in front of Adam, who named the animals, right? Because he wanted to show Adam. Adam had to live by faith, right? So he wanted to show Adam that his complement was lacking. Adam did not have a complement, whereas every other, let's say, almost creature was made male and female, right? However, human male and female is different. That's important. So we understand that the idea of sex and gender, first of all, I think we give money, and again, that is John money, I think we give him too much maybe credit, right? Because again, the idea of gender, we say, oh, there's a male gender and there's a female gender. Not necessarily. There's a male essence and a female essence, right? And so there is maleness and femaleness that's true and that exists, that Adam was made and Eve was made, and they were male and female, yeah, not subspecies, not different species. However, they are then complements of one another. And what made Eve Eve was not simply her biology, even though that's a part of it. It's her ontology. That's the key, I think.
Yep. So in the mind of God, there was and is a category of maleness and femaleness.
Because he made those, right? Now, it's interesting, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but if you think about it, every living thing in the world, every, let's say, creature that was made during the creation week, and I'm going to tip my hat. I do believe Genesis 1 is historic. That's for another podcast. They were made ex nihilo, male and female, right? In a sense, right? So animals and creatures have a male and a female so they can procreate. Matter of fact, that's their whole role in the world, is to then procreate, right? Whereas mankind is somewhat unique, because Eve was not made ex nihilo. She was made from Adam. That's a fascinating thing to think about. Not many people do. Eve was not made ex nihilo. She was made from her husband, from Adam, which means that we are not separate species, and she is not somehow sub. It means that she has the image of God, because that's a part of her essence, her ontology. So I think when we see what's going on in our world with gender, the dysphoria, the chaos, the confusion, it's because we've completely separated the two. Now what it means to be a woman or then to be a man has everything to do with one's experience, not their essence. We have ignored the metaphysical to our severe detriment.
Yeah. So I'm curious how you would answer the question, does God have gender?
Well, not as John Money would say, right? So again, we need to be careful. And I've read, in the past maybe 10 or 15 years, there are complementarians who I think get this wrong, right? That God's a man. He's not a man. He does not have male biology, right? He does not have an X and a Y chromosome, right? Certainly the incarnation that happened, right? But I'm talking about the essence of God, as in the triune God. He is spirit. Mm-hmm. So we need to be careful of that. However, he reveals himself in the masculine language. Remember, I said that gender was relegated to language. Language is nothing more than revelation and philosophy, right? So as God reveals himself to humanity, he reveals himself. God does not have sex or biology, but he does have the masculine, and from that is also the feminine. Now, I'm not saying that God is some sort of a dualist in the sky that has like a feminine part and a masculine part. No, he does not. However, those things as categories are derived from the Imago Dei. Now, certainly we see that in the animal world, which, remember, animals are not made in the image of God. But the idea itself has to arise from the idea of God.
So God may not have a, certain chromosomes or whatever, God is spirit, but God does reveal himself as a father.
That's correct. And not just he reveals himself as a father, he reveals himself as a father because he is the father, mm-hmm. right? So our idea of, let's say, fatherhood has to derive itself from God. Now this gets into our Trinitarian our discussion that we had. I know myself, Kevin Bowner and Matt Schrader had this for quite a while. We need to be careful. Remember, revelation is always top down. Mm-hmm. It's never bottom up. So it's not that God is a father in that you're a father, I'm a father, therefore we extrapolate that upward, right, and then apply that to God. That's not how it works. God is the father, therefore you and I are reflections of that in fatherhood. Because remember, in Scripture, there are metaphors used for God being a mother in a sense as well. So God is the Father, God is the Son, and God is the Spirit. And I think that's very important that we hold to those orthodox categories.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the essentialist view of creation? We got into that a little bit. Is there more you want to say about that? And maybe we could even look at some Scripture passages?
So I think that view is important in two ways. Number one, it shows that essence exists, right? And that the physical comes from that, right? It shows that there's not this wall of maybe separation, that we are material and immaterial, right? So you are then not simply a man because of your biology. You're essentially a man, which includes your biology. Because remember, we have to answer the question of the hermaphrodite, right? John Money, I think I said this last time, he did his dissertation at Harvard on hermaphrodites, which is part of what kind of drove him to the idea of what happens when someone is born with shall I say, both, you know, sex organs, if you will, right? Well, usually now we can see the chromosomes at the same time. The doctors and the parents have to sort of make not a decision about who they are, but a decision about the, I'll say, the sex organs, right? A, that's very rare. It's very rare. B, we need to see that as an exception, not the rule. And C, I think we also need to see that as a result of this fallen world. Not that hermaphrodites are less human or anything like that. I'm using that in the most respectful way I can, but that has to be seen as a result of a fallen world, like someone born with maybe trisomy 21 or something of that nature, right? So I think what the essentialist view does, not only it shows us that proper maybe ontology or theology or even philosophy, but also it talks about how we apply it to how we live, or culture and society. And this is really where the rubber meets the road, right? Because if you're essentialist, you're going to say that there is a woman who is a woman at her core, her essence. Now, she can experience her, let's say, femininity in various ways, different cultures and different societies. That can be relative. Mm-hmm. However, it has to stem from the objective essence that is a woman or a man. So that's why I like the essentialist view, because it shows that how we live in this world, right, the cultural appropriations and how we interact and how we react, that has to be seen as a part, not of simply a sociological construct, but really seen as a reflection of who we are in essence. So there are going to be certain things that will transcend cultures. Right now, the Bible gets into this. This is interesting, and I'll probably get in trouble. But we see an example. First of all, you know, in the book of Deuteronomy, I think it's in chapter 22, that God is very clear that it is an abomination that if a man dresses as a woman or a woman dresses as a man, that's an abomination to the Lord. Why? Well, because men are men and women are women. It's not just a confusion of the categories. It's saying these are distinct categories that God made, and that's important. However, also go to, let's say, like Paul, maybe in 1 Corinthians 11, where he talks about hair, right? It's interesting because while that's written to the church there in Corinth, he adds this little thing right at the end of that paragraph or his discussion. He says that basically we hold to this, and so do all the churches of God. So it's not just some thing that was happening very distinctively, very individualistically to the church in Corinth. This is something that Paul was saying. This is a common thing. And so that whole idea that there is something that's physical that reflects and joins to, inextricably so, the essential or the immaterial. Okay, so women should always look like women. Men should always look like men. Now, what that is, shall I say, in the very specifics of society, that's what's relative, right? So, like, this is my mother, even though she was raised in public schools, she wouldn't have dreamed of wearing pants to a public school. This is in the 1950s, okay? Because all the girls wore skirts, had nothing to do with their church, had everything to do with how society saw girls. Well, now it's pretty rare to find a school that says girls have to wear skirts, right? And so the point of that is to show that there are things that are relative, right? Certain societies saw beards as very masculine. Matter of fact, last time I brought up a few, I think, ancient Christians who had this idea that they're reacting against the Roman, let's say, smooth-faced man, and they're saying Christians have beards. That's something the Reformers did, by the way. You look at pictures and statues, mm-hmm. You're like, wow, yep. These guys were very hairy. Well, part of the reason why is because of some of the rules of the Catholic Church at that time. So these things react. It's like a pendulum that swings back and forth. These things are relative. However, the categories of masculine and feminine are not relative. They are objective because they are ontological. That's the essentialist view.
Okay. So you've talked about some of these categories from a biblical perspective. How has this been viewed classically throughout history? What's the classical perspective of some of these?
Well, I mean, I think it would correspond greatly with how we see the Bible, right? And so that is why, even though in ancient societies you saw a lot of confusion, there was cross-dressing, what we think of homosexuality, right? And maybe that's a later episode. I've said the idea of homosexuality was really invented, right? Because it used to be a behavior. Now it's seen as a person. That came in the late, I'll say, 19th century. However, the behavior of cross-dressing or transvesticism, that's been common throughout history. However, even in the societies that saw it as something common, they recognized categories of male and female. Now, what they did is they tried to either have a combination of the category or maybe jump the categories or even inverse the categories. So what's unique and what's going on now is that it's not that we're trying to jump the categories or even confuse the categories. We've erased them. That's different. And that's very dangerous. This is just my personal view, but I'm not sure how much longer this can last because it is contradictory, right? So if we don't think that a woman really exists, then how can someone be a trans woman?
Yeah.
If you can't define a woman, so if a woman is not her biology, if it's just some sort of an inward experience that she has, then what's a trans woman? Right? So you see these things don't really have definitions, and they're as contradictory as a square circle.
Wow. Yeah. And that kind of leads us to where we are today. And I remember in talking, you and I talked about, you know, the stripping away of the categories, and these are constructs of culture and society. And so the urge is to break through them and break through the modern day structures of these maleness and femaleness. How did that develop? Because and I can't remember if we talked about it in our last episode or you and I just talked in person, even with the homosexual movement, how there was a time when it was kind of secretive, or they didn't try to rally together. They weren't trying to push the agenda. And then all of a sudden they kind of started doing that. They were kind of their own separate movement. And then they wanted to integrate into society. Can you talk about that with us, about that, both in relation to the homosexual movement and transgender movement, and just that push to kind of break through?
Yeah. Well, that was actually several questions, so I'll do my best. And again, I don't want to be reductionistic here. I don't want to sound like these things are so simple. They have some simple maybe explanation or even definition. But I will say this, I think at their core, I think they're very similar. You call it the homosexual movement, right? And this is something that we can talk about later, you know, and maybe we can do another, it's a podcast on it. But the idea or the category of the homosexual is a recent invention.
Right.
And as I said, the behavior has always existed. The question is, what is the behavior then? Does the behavior define the person themselves? So you have the rise of modern psychology in the middle to the latter part of the 19th century. It starts in Germany, and as most things do, they work their way across the pond. It takes 20 to 30 years, so by the beginning of the 20th century in America. But then you add in a little bit of Marxism, you add a lot of individualism, you add all these things, right? So what happens is we invent categories, like we invented the category of a homosexual as a person, as opposed to just a behavior, right? Or we invent this new category of gender, like John Money did. And we invent these categories, except they don't have reference. We can't really define them. So I've done a lot of research on how, since the early 1900s, how the APA, that stands for the American, the Psychological Association. That was a Freudian slip. And yes, that was a pun. Pun intended there. But the American Psychological Association, how they simply and only, it's a 40 or 50 years, have had so many definitions on what homosexuality is. No one can really define it, and no one really understands what causes it, right? So they tried in the 1990s, they put all their eggs in the baskets, maybe genetics, and they did massive studies to try to find the gay gene. Yeah. Well, they've given that up, right? Or they did some sort of like a sociological right? So if someone was abused as a child sexually, then likely they're going to be gay, or it was a construct. And they've tried all these things, all right, these categories that maybe we got from Freud and Skinner and some of the early thinkers of this. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that humans are complex and it's not so simple, right? Yeah. So I think with both things, if you will, whether homosexuality or maybe the idea of gender, we make up categories that don't have definitions. Because if you're going to say that being a woman or being a man is somehow removed then from the biological entirely, and that it's a social construct, then what you're saying is it really doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, who defines it? If no one can define it, how does this someone know, right? So the question's being asked, what's a man or what's a woman, right? That's a part of this modern angst. That's a part of this chaos. That's a part of the contradiction that's happening at the fundamental level.
Okay. So tie this in, you know, we talked a lot of philosophy. We talked a lot of things through history. Tie this into what we're seeing today in our world and how to filter some of these things through our mind when our next door neighbor says, you know, who used to be a man is now a woman. Or our kids' classmates were one and now the other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, it's happening. I even have a lot of personal experience. I'm not going to get into that, but just in this, and it's very difficult, right? So I think this is something we can reduce it to several very basic understandings of what it means to be a Christian. You love God. Right. What that also means is you love his revelation, his truth. You see that as the truth. Right. So in loving the God, you have to love what he says. You have to obey him. So if you apply that, we cannot in any way, shape or form, let's say, compromise on this truth.
Yeah.
Right. And in speaking with gender, I think especially we cannot compromise and say, oh, yes, the idea of, let's say, femininity or masculinity is just a social construct. It has nothing to do with who you are. If we compromise on that, then we're saying we don't really love the revelation that God has given us. That's number one. Number two is love your neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. This is what our Lord and Savior said. This is how we boil it down. Love is essential for Christianity. How you love your neighbor, right? So that is where the rubber meets the road. That's the difficult thing when your child or your niece or your neighbor, let's say, comes to you and says, hey, my name used to be Steve, now it's Nicole, and would you please use these pronouns, right? How do you love them? Well, you cannot love them through the denial of truth, because that's not love. And that's not a fundamentalist view. That's not a conservative view. That's been a Christian view throughout history, right? Hence, love has to be sourced in the truth, because if God is love and God is truth, then work that out, right? However, at the same, let's say, time, we have to understand that how we love them is going to be by sharing the truth. I actually think this is an exciting opportunity for the Church of Jesus Christ. I really do. I think we live in a very unique sense and era. And of course, you know, sin has always been in all culture, all time. But we live in a unique censor era because of this mass, let's say, chaos and confusion. These things are contradictory. We have the truth. And by saying that, I don't mean we are the truth. I mean we have the truth as revealed. And so we can help those who are confused. And I think a lot of the confusion is genuine, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at some of the modern or current research, I should say, that in the past 5 years, this gender dysphoria, okay, or the trans movement, if you will, this is among those who are 18 years and younger, has more than doubled in 5 years.
Wow.
That's a phenomenon that, you know, psychologists have no idea how they answer that. I was actually reading, it was a British, it was a pediatrician who had practiced, let's say, in the UK for many, many decades. And they said that only 10 years ago that someone who was below the age of 18, right, coming, let's say to their office, who had this gender dysphoria, said, mm-hmm. I'm actually a boy or a girl, et cetera. Maybe one or two a year. That's according to this pediatrician. maybe one or two a year. It's very rare. The past 5 years now, it makes up anywhere from 10 to 20% of the pediatrician's healthcare.
Wow.
Right? So something's happening. Now, of course, one side of society would say, well, see, all the... this is all these, let's say, trans people have always existed, right? And they've had to live in the shadows and been hiding, and now we're giving them the freedom. Now they can show who they truly are. Or another side of that would say, well, wait a sec. No, our society has invented this construct. Now we're shoving people into the construct, right? So whichever view I think people show or take. But I think as Christians, we need to reiterate the fact we have the truth. And those, especially young people, they are very confused because social media and culture, they're trying to give them these categories and shove them in the categories. So if you have an 8-year-old girl who likes football and likes to play in the mud, well, it's not because she's a tomboy like she used to be, or it's not because, you know what, actually girls can play in the mud and girls can like football. What's wrong with that, right? No, now it's because, well, she's actually a boy that's trapped inside of a girl's body, and her gender doesn't associate with her biology. So we're taking sin and we're expounding it because categories make it more convenient.
Yeah.
So I think as Christians, this is a unique opportunity for us to say we have the truth, and the truth is that all humans are made in the image of God. Male and female, He made them. Male and female are categories of essence, not simply biology, not simply society. They are categories that God Himself made. They are inviolable, and they are certainly inextricable to how we live in this world. That's our biology, or that's our sociological constructs. They are inextricable, right? So we have to understand that a man is a man because God made him a man, not simply because of his chromosomes, not simply because of his biology. Those things correspond, but it's because he is a man at his sense or essence.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's been really helpful. I think next time we'll get in a little bit more to some practical application, maybe talk about what this looks like through in our everyday life when we are working with those individuals or when we do interact with those who want to change their gender or, you know, change their pronouns or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think we've covered a lot of stuff today with some good history, laid a foundation. Thank you for your time and your work on this episode.
Certainly. Thank you, Jared. I appreciate it.
Next time on the Central Seminary Podcast.
So I think fundamentally we have to see there are two leading maybe theories or views.
And how that has shifted over time from an action I do versus this is who I am.
Yeah, there's a wall of separation in between the true you and the physical you. And that has not been a Christian view.
How should we think about the use of preferred pronouns?
I think that's difficult, and I think it's multifaceted.
Breaking free of the modern construct of gender and separating essence from biology.
They don't have a definition for what makes a man and a woman a woman.
So where does that leave us for today and what we're seeing in our world with sexuality?
This is becoming a central issue in today's society.
What do we do? What does the church do? How do we handle some of these things? Look for our next episode on the Central Seminary Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Central Seminary Podcast. Our mission at Central Seminary is to assist New Testament churches in equipping spiritual leaders for Christ-exalting biblical ministry. Since its founding in 1956, Central Seminary has sought to provide serious students of God's Word with robust theological education as they prepare for ministry. We have many graduates around the world who are serving in countless ways to spread the gospel and proclaim the name of Jesus Christ. Find out more at our website, centralseminary.edu.